Okay? All right. So it's a great time to be a neuroscientist, right? Because things that we only dreamed of 20 years ago are now a routine possibility. Perhaps even boring, as you pointed out. I'm sure this kind of data has been shown before, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, this is imaging of a population activity in awake behaving animal in the visual cortex of a mouse watching a virtual reality movie, and each of those blobs are neurons lighting up, indicating their activity. Of course, you can't just publish the video, so what you really want to get out of this are activity traces. And that for a while has been a stumbling block because it takes students more time to extract activity traces from those videos than to actually do the imaging experiment, because they had to manually circumscribe all those neurons in multiple frames, and you know there's motion artifacts, so there was a lot of work going into extracting those traces. So this is a shameless plug for a piece of software developed in my group at Flatiron called Kaman, which extracts activity traces automatically. So you don't have to draw the borders anymore. The software draws the borders and extracts the temporal traces like this automatically. You know, all you have, and you can just sit there and sip coffee, basically. This is also...
My graduate students more free time.
Well, so that you can occupy them with other routine and boring tasks. I'm sorry?
It's after motion correction.
This is after motion correction. Okay, so this is a good point to introduce the variables that we will use. We will talk about neural activity vectors, each component of which will be an activity of each neuron, and we are not going to worry about spike timing, so this will be firing rates or a gradient neurons, just voltage. And those are, of course, elicited in response to the stimulus vector, which for the visual stimulus is just pixel intensities. Okay, so now that we got those traces, and this all kind of became boring, the big question is, what does this all mean, right? What are those activity traces actually tell you? And to make it a little bit more concrete, I distilled it to two questions. What does neural activity represent? And how is that representation computed? Okay, and so we'll try to answer these questions in the talk today. Of course, you know, we're not the first to ask these questions. You know, a traditional answer to the first question, we'll call it reconstruction approach, which is also called linear decoding, is based on a very simple postulate. And this is basically assuming that the activity of the population of neurons in the corresponding visual area corresponding to the modality of the stimulus, so the stimulus is visual stimulus, this is primary visual cortex, tries to reconstruct what the animal is seeing, right? And more specifically, if the sensory stimulus can be written down as a vector, how do you form this vector? You basically take pixel intensity in this patch and rearrange those as a vector. That will be boldface X. You can reconstruct that X in the basis of neuronal features vector, feature vectors W, K. And those feature vectors can be also shown as these patches, right? And we know that in the visual cortex, neuronal feature vectors, which is their preferred stimulus, are these Gabor patches which differ among neurons in their orientation and spatial frequency and location. Okay? But then what you do, you for each neuron, you take this feature vector, you weight it by the neuronal activity, and you add up. And so you basically, it's basically a decomposition of the stimulus vector into the basis of those feature vectors of individual neurons here, right, where the activity are the coefficients on each dimension, except that the basis is, of course, not really a basis because it's not orthogonal, some kind of a overcomplete basis or a frame.
Basis scatters. Huh? How many W's you have? How many of them?
More than pixels, more than the dimensions of X. So it's an overcomplete basis.
I see.
Okay? So they cannot possibly be orthogonal, and they're not. And that's the idea of the reconstruction approach. And that simple postulate led to a lot of theoretical work, much of which was very successful and explained experimental result. Even my group contributed a little bit. And so there must be something true to this assumption, but it also ran into some difficulties. And one difficulty to this view is that activity patterns elicited by the same stimulus in different individual brains will be different, at least if you're a mammal. Okay? So why is that a problem? Well, the problem arises with the invariance of concepts, right? So if I tell you the word red, it will elicit different activity patterns in each one of your brains. So how can we assure that you perceive the same color when I tell you the word red? How can that invariance be assured? And the second issue is a little bit more technical, because if you actually take this seriously and you write down an optimization problem in terms of minimizing the mismatch between the stimulus vector X and the reconstructed vector of the sum squared, you can actually do the optimization problem and derive a circuit where the dynamics of neuronal activity and the plasticity of synaptic weights will correspond to the steps of the optimization problem, optimization algorithm. But unfortunately, when you take this route, the learning rules, that is the updates of the synaptic weights that you get from this derivation, are non-local. And by that I mean that the synaptic weight will depend not just the activity on the activity of the two neurons that the synapse connects, which is perfectly fine, but also on the activity of many other neurons in the system, which cannot be happening because a synapse doesn't have access to that information. So this kind of violates this very important biological and, if you wish, actually physical constraint. And so that was the second problem with the reconstruction approach.
Please. So this problem is just an issue if you had treated this as an optimization problem, it's the optimization itself. That's.
I don't think there is a problem with the solution if you were to write X minus sum of WY squared and to minimize it with respect to W and Y. The solution is fine, and for example, Holzhausen and Field were able to learn this Gabor patches as a solution under the sparseness regularizer. But the algorithm that you actually write down when you map it onto a neuronal network will have this non-local updates. So that's the problem. Okay? So motivated by these challenges, we tried to look for another principle to get to the circuits and the dynamics and come up with an alternative optimization framework that doesn't suffer from those problems.
Yes. You didn't say where time is figuring in the X's and Y's and whatnot.
So the time will not play any significant role in today's talks. The only thing that to keep in mind is that stimuli are coming one at a time, and we are not looking at a correlation in time. So all I'm going to have an index that will appear will be XT that will just enumerate the stimuli and the responses.
But in those images of the neural recordings, one can infer causality from the time, potentially.
Yeah, so we will just break down those images into bins, and we will assume, we will not look at the correlations between bins. We will assume that these are statistically independent frames. So don't think about watching a movie, think about watching a sequence of static photographs shown in an animal, and the order of these photographs is randomly chosen. It's of course not the way the brain actually does it, but that's the simplification we'll make.
But neuron reaction depends on the previous state of neurons.
It could, and it does. We assume that we waited long enough to erase that effect between stimuli. Okay? All right. So before I tell you what our solution to this problem is, let me motivate it a little bit by showing some experimental results. And this one comes from a completely different world, functional magnetic resonance imaging. And actually in human area, inferotemporal cortex, which is a higher visual area. So what they did, they put subjects into the MRI scanner, and they showed them a bunch of different visual stimuli, like human faces, animal faces, body parts, household objects, and if you live in the US. And then they recorded, in response to each stimulus, a vector of activity, okay? But because it's MRI, each component of a vector is activity not of an individual neuron, but MRI voxel, which, it's 10,000 neurons. Nevertheless, they recorded those vectors, and then they computed Pearson correlation, or in the product, or similarity, between all possible pairs of the activity vectors elicited by different stimuli. And the purple color of the pixels corresponds to correlation coefficient of 1, and that is, of course, when you correlate the activity pattern to itself on the diagonal. But you can also see that there is an off-diagonal pattern, these blocks that happen to correspond to this higher-order cognitive categories like animate and inanimate. What that tells you is that activity patterns elicited by two animate objects, okay, are more similar to each other than the activity patterns elicited by an inanimate object and animate object. Well, that by itself may not seem too surprising. We knew before that area IT is interested in things like animate and inanimate, and there may be spatial organization correlating with those categories. But what is truly surprising, I think, is the invariance of such similarity matrix.
So when you say animate object, these are moving objects, but the stimulus is...
No, these are still photographs, static photographs, yeah. So the invariance is truly striking. This similarity matrix is very reproducible across individuals, and not just of the same species. Okay, here is a similarity matrix measured in macaque monkey IT, area IT, and not by fMRI, but by single unit electrophysiology. Okay, so now the components of the activity vector are really neuronal activities. And when you compute the similarity matrix, you get rather similar structure, okay? So the similarity matrix is rather invariant. And that, I think, is surprising.
You have similarity matrix between images. So when you say that it's invariant, I guess you assume that images share the same, have the same similarity as the activity. Did you compare the similarity between images to similarity matrix?
So on the pixel level, there is no preference for similarity between this category, the images of this category, right? So they may not have corrected this exactly for all possible statistics. Right, so that may not have been controlled, but the idea is that if it were, then this result would still hold.
No, but I can imagine like a rock looking like a face, right?
Right.
Or a statue.
That's the point. And I'll show you in a moment. I'll show you the same similarity measured in the primary visual area V1 to this object, and there will be no structure. Perhaps that would answer your question.
No, but what do you mean by invariance when you say invariance?
So I show these images to many different people, compute the similarity matrix, and it comes out very similar. Is that okay? So this result is from the visual cortex. But now, actually, there are experimental measurements in olfaction, both in mammals and flies, that show the same level of invariance. So even though individual activity patterns in individual animals are not invariant, even the number of neurons could be different, the similarity matrices seem to be invariant, and it's holding now, as we know, across modalities.
Is it still, what does it mean to be inanimate and animate in olfaction? Or is it
in olfaction, there are just like different, groups of orders,
so they're grouped by like
aromatic
type.
And, attractive, repulsive, yeah. Not animate and inanimate.
With olfaction, I've always seen these things grouped by chemical structure, right? So, I mean, is that just a reflection of the fact that things with similar chemical structures activate the same receptors? I mean, because this is something different, right? This is in neurons.
So those experiments were done in flies, were done on Kenyan cells. So that's not receptors. And in mammals, they were done in the piriform cortex. So that's, two steps removed from the receptors.
But if you looked at the receptors and found the similarity matrices in the receptor, then it wouldn't be surprising that you find the similarity matrices in downstream, right? I wouldn't find the similarity matrix looking at retina.
Okay. So this is a good question, and I was going to get this in a couple of slides, but if you measure the same similarity matrix on the activity in the retina or in V1, you would not see that structure. The same story holds in olfaction. There is one similarity matrix on the level of olfactory receptor neurons and another similarity matrix on the level of Kenyan cells or piriform cortex. Those are not the same. Okay? But there is still invariance among individuals if you keep measuring in the same area. Okay? All right.
I'm just a little bit confused. As soon as I don't have identified neurons,
mm-hmm.
then in some way I'm guaranteed that the patterns of neural activity are individualistic. And in fact, even with identified neurons, we know that you can distinguish individual. You play the same stimulus to two different individuals, record from the same identified neuron, and you can tell the individuals apart.
Yeah.
So, And by the time you get to the cortex, right, voxels I'm not sure about, but, there's no sense in which I could say that neuron number 17 in this animal corresponds to ours. So then, this has got to be more similar than, right? So the fact, for example...
It didn't have to be.
Well, but for instance, if similarity measures something like discriminability, then... which you might hope it does, there's technical questions, right? So certainly people have done things like that. Then the fact that you and I have similar discrimination performance, if we're recording from the neurons that contribute to making the discrimination, then something like this has to be true, right?
That's right. But this is in the middle of the brain. This is not the record, you could hope that this would be true, but again, this did not have to hold in the second order correlation. It could have been embedded in higher order correlations.
Depends a little bit on what you think the relationship this is to your perception.
Right. So you could have hoped that this would work, but it does, right? So that's the empirical evidence. So this is great, right? Because the invariance of similarity resolves the first challenge to the reconstruction approach, right? Because even though the word red elicits different activity patterns in each one of your brains, I can still maintain the invariance of concepts because the similarity of that activity pattern is the same to other related concepts like colors pink and orange and the word blood. are the same across individuals. Okay? And that's what may be responsible for the similarity of concepts. This is, of course, a hypothesis. Okay? But at least the similarity-based description gives you that possibility. Okay. So what else? Yeah, so right. So that explains the concepts. And we were not the ones who pointed this out first. There is an old paper from Shimon Edelman, who is not Jerry Edelman, who entitled the paper basically "Representation is Representation of Similarity." Okay, so this idea has been around for a while, and you know, if you have a computer science background, it's like thinking about kernels. So that there is a lot of thought in that respect. So this is our answer to the first question, what does neural activity represent? And the second question is, how is the neural activity computed? And for that, let's look at the visual pathway. And there's a sequential areas starting from the retina and LGN, V1, V2, IT. So the MRI results I showed you before are from this pretty deep area, IT. But as I mentioned in response to Alex's question, if I did the same experiment presenting the same stimuli and computing similarity in V1, I will see no structure. This is, of course, not surprising because, we would think that the appearance of edges of different orientation, which is what V1 cares about, should be similar across animate and inanimate stimuli. So, why would you expect structure, right? And the same, of course, is true in the retina level, right? Pixel level representations are not reflecting such high order cognitive categories.
Okay, I'm sorry, I don't mean to I think there is a little bit of cheating here because you grouped the similarities on the left according to what you think the area is doing, but you haven't grouped them on the left. You haven't grouped them because, for example, if it's a low level area like V1, right, the features that are in different images may be similar. So if you group the images according to the features, maybe you would see some similarity.
Very good. And that's exactly what happens. So if we take bars of different orientations and drift them in direction orthogonal to the orientation, we will discover structure in the similarity matrix in V1 because that's the right feature for V1. Okay? So, yes, there is structure in similarity matrices on different levels, but that structure is revealed in terms of different features.
But then when you say that neurons represent similarity, what exactly do you mean?
That's just a restatement of the fact that the similarity matrix in terms of the appropriate features in the same cortical area of different individuals stays invariant.
So they can actually distinguish, it's not just a dot product between two vectors.
So
the correlation, if you look at the correlation of the first and second, so that's blue.
Yeah.
And the first and one, two, three, four, five, six, that's yellow.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. So, okay. So what's happening here is that, and it's my fault totally. These are drifting bars, and this one drifts to the right. This one drifts to the right, northeast. This one drifts north. This one drifts northwest. This one drifts west-northwest. And this one drifts west. Okay, velocity is opposite even though orientation is the same. That's why you have this subband. Sorry about that. I should fix this.
So could you say that the concepts in your similarity matrix, in the one on the right, are also features of some more abstract concepts represented in another similarity matrix. So for example, a face that's expressing a certain emotion may be a more abstract concept than just a face, right? So these could be also considered features.
Right.
And then if you look at those more abstract concepts, you would see similar relationship between these matrices, as you see here, between orientations and...
Right. There are multiple ways to look at the same cortical areas, just like there, you can use the same way to look at different cortical areas. You can use multiple features to look at the same cortical area. Yeah.
What does velocity echo? It's like static images?
No. These are moving gratings.
Okay.
Sorry.
May I just ask? So suppose the area, like each individual area, will project the image on some manifold that is relevant, that actually is representative of this area, right? So it will give you, for example, the space of faces, or the space of objects, or the space of edges, right? Something like that. Would you expect the same result? So suppose the role of area is not really to represent similarity, but to project the image onto some multidimensional manifold.
Well, yes, that where we are heading, but it's different. So similarity-based description gives you more leverage in terms of manifold learning. That's what I'm heading to, than the reconstruction approach.
Yes.
All right, so but the big question is, so it's clear now that the big question is, right, beyond what does neural activity represent, how is it, you know, neural activity, neural representation and features are transformed when you go from one area to the next? That's the big question. And although we don't have a complete answer, we've been developing a hypothesis which we call similarity alignment or similarity matching, which basically starts with a very simple postulate that replaces now the reconstruction approach, which says that if you have a layer in the neural network, just think of a single layer, then similar input activity patterns evoke similar output activity patterns. Okay? Of course, you can always remap the inputs to outputs identically. So we have to do something to prevent that possibility. So we will impose some constraints, and which will fight this kind of trend, but it's actually amazing how much we could get out of that simple kind of hypothesis, and we were able to develop algorithms that map into neural circuits that solve a large number of machine learning problems. And one problem that I want to talk about today has to do with categorization, right? So if you have, you know, plants and pets, and these are different images, how do you differentiate between them? If I showed you a new pet or a new plant, could you differentiate between them? But unlike the way that computer scientists like to do it in a supervised setting with deep learning, we are not going to show any labels. And I think this is much more appropriate to biology, because I think in biology, most of the learning does not happen on huge labeled data sets that have been carefully annotated. Okay, it happens on just like, you know, exploring the world. And when you explore the world, those images appear to you as vectors in the high dimensional pixel intensity space, and usually without labels. And so the problem that we will start with is just to cluster this points, and the two clusters will correspond to plants and pets, but we will do it without looking at the labels.
But there is some assumption that all pets are close in some Euclidean measure space, and you have to explain us how one learns this by unsupervised means.
Yes, so...
I can have a pet rock, right?
Yeah, so in the first... This is part one. So in part one, I'm asking you to grant me an assumption that the points corresponding to one category are closer to each other than any two points between different categories. So we have segregated clouds. So this is, yes, I know this seems very easy, but that's for us to warm up, and we'll get to a harder situation with entanglement in part two.
All right, how does the number of objects compare to the number of dimensions?
Doesn't matter. Could be greater, could be less.
I mean, if the space is really high dimensional, does everything just kind of go periphery?
So, let's not worry about this.
Okay.
It works in a high dimensional space too, but yeah, but it's an interesting question to explore offline. So you would say, you know, Boris would say, oh, this is easy, this is just clustering, and, you know, we know how to solve it, you know, k-means or any number of clustering methods for machine learning will do it. Well, the problem is that we want to do it in a biologically plausible way. We want to map this onto real biological neurons, and so we don't want to violate any biological constraints, okay? So the goal here is to do this biologically plausible, and so we basically going to do it from the ground up. We will come to something very close to k-means, but we will have a biologically plausible algorithm for that. And the program for doing that is actually similar to what has been done in other normative approaches, like reconstruction approach. We will start with writing down an objective function, right? Like an energy function in physics, which would give you clustering. Then we will optimize it by proposing an online algorithm, okay? What does online mean? Well, that's an important distinction, right? Because you can't, biological systems, they cannot cluster like, you know, statisticians used to by just loading a whole data set in the computer memory, crunching the numbers, and then computing assignment indices. Biological organisms don't usually have access to the whole data set at once. The data is streamed to them one at a time, right? Because the world is coming at you. And they cannot wait for the arrival of the whole data set to compute the assignment indices, right? That will be too late, right? So you have to compute assignment indices on the fly, right? Before the next stimulus arrives, you have to assign it to plat or pent, and that's important for survival. And you have to make those assignments and learn those categories without storing any significant amount of the data set, because neurons, at least on the level of individual neurons and mini circuits, don't have access to large memory chips. And so they cannot store the input data or their previous assignment indices. All they can perhaps store is some very limited amount of information, some kind of sufficient statistic. Okay, so that's what we mean by an online algorithm. And then we will map this online algorithm onto a neural network, and we will try to respect as many biological constraints as possible. The dynamics of neural activity and the synaptic plasticity will correspond to the steps of the algorithm, and we will make sure that the plasticity roles are local, as to respect biology. So this is very similar to the approach, to the reconstruction approach, Holzhausen and Fields' work, and others. But because the starting point is different, we will get, I think, a more biologically plausible circuit.
Can you say, just to be clear, by local, you're not excluding some sort of a global scalar, like a reinforcement signal or something like that, right?
Yeah, so a few scalars we can always throw in. There is always option for that. Although I'm not doing reinforcement here, it is easily incorporating in terms of, like, you know, attention variable or significance variable. So we can weigh different examples to different extent.
Can you also
use the information, like let's say, information about the meaning of the kind of higher level information about the picture that I see in order to. You said
no. This is just a single layer which just clusters the clouds.
Okay.
How to get to stacking layers? We will talk in the very end.
So you don't use, for example, like the meaning of a picture, like say to distinguish, say I don't know, a cat from a tiger, just
no.
because one is dangerous and the other is not.
No. Just looking at the vectors in the pixel intensity space, and we are still doing the example where these are just two segregated clusters, clouds. Okay. So now there will be now two slides with some math and equations. But there is a reward in the end, because once we are done with that, we will compare our predictions with experiments, both involving kinetomics and population activity. And I promise you that there will be a very exciting result. Okay? So what's clustering? Well, the output of clustering are basically this assignment index vector, right? Where each component of the vector varies between zero in the interval from 0 to 1, or in hard clustering, it's just 0 and 1. And it's 1 if a particular data point belongs to that cluster, and 0 if it doesn't belong to this cluster. In hard clustering, there can only be 1, 1 in the vector. Okay, so the reds are 1, 0s, the blue are 0, 1s. Right, that's just a mathematical way to describe the output of cluster. So now, what does that mean in terms of similarity? Since we like similarity, what does it mean? Well, so points in the same cluster are more similar to each other than points in different clusters. So maybe we can do clustering just by thresholding input similarity. So we take the inner product between two examples, xt and x tau. And if it's greater than alpha, we ask output similarity to be 1. If it's below, we ask output similarity to be 0. Why would that work? Well, what does it mean to have similarity 1? You have two vectors, inner product of two vectors. Each component is between 0 and 1, and the norm is 1. So to get this result, those two vectors have to be the same. They have to have one and the same for the same element. So they would have to assign those that data point to the same cluster. Okay. So similarity equals 1 means you assign them to the same cluster. Output similarity is 0 means that the two assignment indices index vectors are orthogonal, and that can only happen if those two data points are assigned to different clusters. So threshold and similarities will perform cluster. Okay, now what kind of objective function will perform such a thresholding? Well, here is one example. Again, under this constraints that the norm of y is below 1 and each component is non-negative, which is what is true for assignment indices, this would do the thresholding, right? Because if the input similarity between a pair of inputs T and tau is greater than alpha, parenthesis is positive, to maximize this product, you want y tau to be as big as possible, the biggest it can be 1, which is the output of thresholding. And if the input similarity is less than alpha, the parenthesis is negative. So given that it's negative, how do you maximize it? Because y's cannot be negative, the best thing you can do is to set the similarity to 0, which is the correct output that we want. So we basically set up the objective to give us the result we want. Okay? But this is only, but this of course works for a pair of stimuli. In reality, it has to work for all possible pair of stimuli. So we're just going to add it up by summing over T and tau. So these are all possible pairs. So we're basically summing over that similarity matrix, right, under these constraints. Now, will it work? It's not obvious that it will, and actually it will not at all situations, because the different similarities are actually, there are T squared of those, right, capital T squared of those, but the parameters here are only T of them. right? So we may not be able to arrange the situation where we respect this similarity thresholding. But there is a situation where we could, and that's the situation where all the similarities within categories are greater than alpha, and all the similarities across categories are less than alpha. Where there is such segregation of similarities, then it can be proven that the solution of this optimization problem will give you this kind of matrix. We only going to have a rank 2 matrix because we will have 2 classes, and that matrix will have this form where this will be all 1s and this will be all 0s, right, from similarity thresholding. And of course, that would correspond to having 2 neurons, one lighting up in respect to pets and the other one lighting up in respect to plants.
Wouldn't this be maximized if the number of classes equal to the number of points?
Well, the number of classes equal to the number of points, you can choose alpha so that only the diagonal is 1s and the off-diagonal is 0. But it'd still be true.
The broader question, how do we pick the number of classes?
Yeah, so that is reflected in the parameter alpha, and you hand pick it. Okay, so this kind of optimization problem seems to work, but it is working now so far in the offline setting, right, where you have all the data, you can solve this optimization problem. But I made such a big deal about biological organisms having to solve this problem in the online setting. How is that possible, right? Because, you know, here this is sum over all t and tau, so examples that came in different times are combined in pairs that have to interact with each other to compute this function. So how can it possibly be done online? And so our major contribution has been in proposing an online algorithm that does exactly that. And just really quickly to give you an idea of the trick. So first, one thing that I should tell you that might confuse you is that instead of having those constraints and dragging them around, because we want something biologically plausible, we use Lagrange multipliers for them. These are the Z's here, right, that also are non-negative. But what happens here is that if you don't worry about the second term for a minute, but look at the first term, we can expand this product of X's and Y's and exchange the orders of Y and X. And once we've done that, you notice that this quantity in the parenthesis is simply a sample covariance. And sample covariance is great because if you're operating in an online setting and you're streaming X's and you're outputting Y's, then after some time, once you look at large enough number of pairs of Y and X, sample covariance doesn't change much from time step to time step. So at any given time step, you can use that sample covariance from the previous time step. And that simplifies the problem significantly so that at each time step, you can find the appropriate YT, the assignment indices, simply by iterating this function, which you get simply by taking a derivative with respect to Y, and to respect the non-negativity constraint, you add the rectification. Okay? And why is that great? Well, because this is... Yes, question?
I'm a little bit lost, so can you please explain maybe just slow,
yeah.
why it's a simple covariance? Sorry, maybe I just, because you have, why is the output?
Why is the output? So it's a covariance between the output vector Y and the input vector X, and this is the outer product, right? So you have this covariance matrix, doesn't have to be square, okay? And for each time point, you have this rank 1 matrix. Then you sum over all time points, and then you build up your sample covariance. Okay? I know it's hard to follow equations when they appear on the screen. So, but the point is, so we're slowly coming out of the equation world and going into the neuroscience world. So this iteration is beautiful because it can be naturally implemented by a neural network of rather biologically plausible architecture, where this matrix vector multiplication can be implemented by passing the input vectors x through the synaptic weight matrix w, and then of course you summon those neurons along with this other term, which will be contributed by the feedback inhibition activity of which encodes those Lagrange multipliers. And then there is also a bias, don't worry about it. And then you have a rectification, which is what neurons do anyways, because the fine rates have to be non-negative. So this iteration can be implemented by recurrent activity in this circuit in response to a presented stimulus or upstream activity X. Once the iteration converges, you're ready to output your final Y, and you can move on and ready to process the next stimulus, the next time step. Okay? So now you see what happens. We have an online algorithm.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm lost, and maybe other people are.
Yeah.
XT, comma 1, XT, comma 2 are different features of the same.
So these are different components of the vector XT.
Okay.
So each data point is XT, XT and then XT plus 1, XT plus 2. And each component of that vector is XT1, XT2, which is the activity of different upstream neurons. Okay?
So in general, the end of those, and they go all across time.
Say it again?
It's not just a two-dimensional stimulus.
No. It can be n-dimensional stimulus. And yes, all of them provide inputs to all neurons. Okay? But the W's, right, these are this covariance, well, it's normalized, but it's covariance matrix, right, which is encoded in the synaptic weights. So we avoided this problem of having to store all the previous stimuli by storing just the sufficient statistics, which is WYX, which is just the covariance between input and output, which is enough for you to do the classification. Where does that statistic come from?
Sorry, what is YT1 and YT2?
So these are components of a vector YT.
And there's like
M. So these are like indicator indices. Yes, how many classes? It depends on how many classes. If you have just two classes, you have just two, and so on.
And so there would be M, with M is the dimension of the classification space. There's M excitatory nodes.
That's right.
And they, each one gets N inputs from this.
That's right. Oh. That's right. Thank you.
So you're naming a correspondence between this gradient step and a network implementation of it?
Yes.
It seems like for maybe a large class of cost functions, you could do the same thing. If you just do, this is essentially just gradient descent, but you're making
yes.
a correspondence.
And that's correct. That's correct. So that's not big news, and that you could get from the reconstruction approach too. The big news is, where do those W's come from? Okay, they're learned, and the learning rule here, unlike most other algorithms that you know about, is local. So the synaptic weight update depends only on the activity of the two neurons that the synapse connects. So I made the subscripts explicit here. So this is WIJ, meaning this is a synapse that connects neuron YI and neuron XJ. And these are the only two activities that affect that synaptic weight. So that is the crucial result that respects the locality of biological learning. In this case, it's simply Hedian. Okay? But that's the main advantage of this approach.
So this is similar to
Hoyer's rule,
right?
This is, if you had one class only, this would be exactly Hoyer's rule. When there are multiple classes, then there is a slight question about how you normalize. So it doesn't have to be exactly Hoyer's rule. But it's in spirit, it's very close. And for one neuron, it's exactly that. I should also say that there have been other networks which did clustering using winner-take-all competition, which is basically what this inhibitory interneuron implements, but they did not offer a biologically plausible implementation which uses only local learning rules. So that's the little advantage.
There was this question of setting alpha so that you end up with a right number of clusters. So where is it in online? So
yeah, so you still have to set alpha. Yeah, there is nothing you can do. I mean, you can have a self-consistent mechanism of choosing alpha in terms of another meta parameter, okay? But there will in the end be something that you have to set by hand.
But it does not show up in the Hebb rule, or it does? I guess it does indirectly.
Not directly, no. Okay. I think this is correct. Not directly.
The network is set up independent. So when you fix alpha, you set up the network.
The architecture of the network is invariant to alpha.
If you change the number of clusters, you change the number of dimensionality of Y.
Yes.
So you have different number of excitatory yields.
Yes.
So the architecture is the same, but the network is different. You have different number of nodes.
So the way you can do it, you can overproduce those principal neurons. But alpha chooses how many of them get engaged, get wired up. So if you start with zero connectivity, with W is equal to zero, and you start hooking up those principal neurons as you go along, then alpha will determine how many of them will get recruited. And the others will just remain unconnected. And that will set the number of clusters.
So you're still trying to understand how the thresholds are set. What is B? I don't think you can find it.
Okay, so B will come out of this term, right, where it will be just sum of the activity of the
normalization.
It's just the total cumulative activity of the particular Y component. Okay, your sum in calcium, basically.
What's it related to Dean's question? So I think also in some sense, there's a strict all-dog connectivity to the inhibitory neurons, right? Everybody goes to him.
Yeah. So this is like
presumably if you have multiple neurons per class or something. I mean, how strict is that all-to-all?
So in this implementation, there's one inhibitory neuron, and it reciprocally connects, and those rules actually, in this case, they are Hebbian, but they don't have to be. They can be just activity-dependent, not correlation-dependent. Now, we also have networks like this with multiple inhibitory neurons that optimize slightly different objective function. So you can choose, Okay, so now we have this framework where we, it's a normative approach, so we have an objective function, we know what its solution is, and we can correspond it to network that optimizes that objective function online, and we maintain that it is more biologically plausible than other networks on the market. But how well does it work in terms of clustering? So here is a simple example, right? So this is a two-dimensional data set with three clouds, blue, red, and green. So we have three principal neurons corresponding to three clouds, and we present one data point at a time in a sequence indicated by those numbers. So first we do all blue, then all green, then all red, which is the worst possible thing you could do for clustering. And the output of the network shown in different colors. So this is for the blue principal neuron. It could be either one of those three, but let's say it's the first one. And it activates in response to the first five stimuli. Then the second comes up in response to the second five. And the third comes up in response to the third. So it does cluster. An interesting twist on this story is that it's actually a slightly more modified objective function than the one I showed you before. And the point of that modification was to allow soft clustering, right? So that assignment indices are not just ones and zeros, but it could be any number between 0 and 1. You just have to respect that the norm is 1. And the reason this is interesting is because this point, okay, we know that it was generated by a noise off the red cluster centroid. But the network doesn't know it because it's blinded to the colors. So it just sees 13, and it's between the blue cluster and the red cluster, so it doesn't know what to do, and it assigns partially to both clusters. I don't think it's a bug. It's more like a feature, because soft clustering is good for you if you are doing a multi-stage computation, because you want to avoid making hard decisions to the last point, and we will see how that actually plays out in a little bit. So the network does cluster. Now you can try to break down how it does it. And that's, again, not very different conceptually from the previous winner-take-all networks. An input vector comes in, and it gets multiplied by three different feature vectors corresponding to the three neurons. And those feature vectors are actually the centroids of those clusters. Okay. And so the neuron whose cluster centroid or feature vector is closest to the data point gets activated the most. And thanks to this winner-take-all competition, it is the one that goes to non-zero activity, suppressing all the other ones. And the W's get adjusted as you go along using that local learning rule, because once you get a new data point, you get, you know, a little bump towards W, so that it accounts for, you know, averages the data points that have been assigned to that cluster, as is usual done in clustering.
And so presumably this would work better if they weren't presented in a particular order by cluster, if they were mixed up.
Yeah, so if you scramble the order, it will only work better, right? By the way, I mean, if someone, I don't know, of a computer science background here, this kind of algorithm is not going to work in an adversarial setting. If someone is trying to choose the particularly bad order to throw me off, they will. Right? There's no such guarantee. But it does work in stochastic setting where I choose the order randomly.
Should we see the first cluster in between 1 and 3 and then 2 and 4 before getting to the... So the
yeah, exactly. When you show 1, the synaptic weight vector points exactly at 1. When you show 2, it goes in between them, right?
Yeah, but where the... At this moment, if you don't show other stuff, I would like to cluster them into groups. If you stop here...
So that depends on the value of alpha. If you chose alpha such that you would have many more clusters, you would.
No. But at the beginning, your system does know how many samples you present. It knows how many clusters.
Right.
But it
alpha determines how easy it is to recruit a new cluster centroid neuron. So if you make it hard to recruit new ones, it keeps the number of clusters low.
So you do need to know the statistics, because if you stop on the fourth sample, you should have two clusters, or not? After four samples?
No. It's online. So once you chose this particular value of alpha, this will all correspond. So that's what happens in time. This will all be assigned to one cluster. Okay? You could have chosen a different value of alpha, so that, you know, only the first was, you know, would be green, blue, and then the second one will be green, will be another neuron. That alpha is hand-picked, yes, but that's the only thing that is hand-picked here.
I remember now projects, you have this idea of neurogenesis, when under certain conditions you would add new intermediate neurons, so can that possibly apply to this one, and if so, what could be these conditions to add a new cluster neuron to this frame?
I mean, in theory, yes, but you know, it takes a very long time to add a neuron. So, you know, what you could see is that there is not enough cumulative activation in the population of the principal neurons that would facilitate the addition of another neuron to the circuit. So if you don't have enough neurons to, you know, to have an assignment index of one, then you will make another neuron that will. Whether it's, I'm skeptical whether the, you know, the neurogenesis is the first mechanism to do that. I would rather say that, you know, adjust the synaptic weights to get there. But it could be that the new stimulus is so far apart that you have to make a new neuron. Then sure.
I don't understand this, how time matters here. I mean, if the task is to classify objects, why should it work better when I present just all elements in the same cluster first and then other elements of another cluster and then another cluster again? So why, if I shuffle the data, why should this work? I mean,
it's just basically a statement that the algorithm typically does better when it knows the span of the data or as early as possible. If you keep it in the dark about the span, total span of the data, then it will perform worse. But we can discuss this offline. It gets technical. Okay. So at least the network works, you know, it seems biologically plausible. It does clustering online in a single pass example like this, so it can do something useful, right? But does it have anything to do with real neurons, with real data? And so we wanted to test it for a long time. We tried to search for all possible experimental settings, and we couldn't find anything where, any place where we could test it, except for you guessed it, fly larva olfactory system. Okay, so that's the system where the completeness of experimental data allowed us to test this theory. As must have been mentioned before in this course, in the very front end of the olfactory system of fly larva, you have 20, well, actually 21, but I'm a physicist, so I'll say 20 ORNs. Okay, each one expressing a different olfactory receptor. Okay, and so when you present an order, a different combination of those ORNs light up, right? But right behind those ORNs, there are several interneurons. I'm drawing only one, again, because I'm a physicist, I'm simplifying, right? And the connectomics approach, which is a collaboration of the Cardona and Samuel labs, has completely mapped out the circuit, not just including the who is connected to who, but with how many synapses, which gives you the complete synaptic weight vector W for the ORN to I projection. So we have this 20-dimensional vector of synaptic weights. Okay. What we also have, thanks to the work in the Samuel lab, from calcium imaging experiments, just like the ones I showed you in the beginning and the Mark showed you, okay, they were able to record activity vectors in all of those 20 ORNs in response to different olfactory stimuli. You can't read those, but these are different chemicals, so it doesn't matter. Okay? But in response to one chemical, you get only this ORN activated. In response to the second chemical, you get this guy, and in lesser degree, those guys. So you get those four activated. So in response to each order presentation, you get a different activity patterns in ORN. Okay? And they chose this set of olfactory stimuli to span the olfactory space as well as they could. Okay, whatever that means. Now, what we are saying is that if you have this kind of activity space, activity data, then the synaptic weight vector here should correspond to the cluster centroid, okay? The first and the major cluster centroid that emerges from this data set. And so we compared the synaptic weight vector in blue with the centroid of this data. and we found a reasonable match. Now, you can complain about these deviations, of course, but keep in mind that we proceed on the assumption that this circuit evolved and learned to operate in natural environment. Okay? So we think that it could be adapted to the natural ensemble of stimuli, which, of course, remains unknown. In olfaction, we don't know what that is. So it's a stroke of luck, I think, that we were able to find correspondence for this set of stimuli chosen simply from the consideration to spend the olfactory space as well as possible.
There's only one interneuron.
No, there isn't. As I mentioned before, there are multiple, okay? But I just want to keep things simple. But I also should be honest. And we were not able to, we are not able yet to match the cluster centroids, the other cluster centroids from this data set, to the synaptic weight vectors onto other interneurons. We don't know yet which, whether this is caused by the deficiency of this data set, that it's not natural stimulus kind of data set, or it reflects something about our understanding.
So a lot of interneurons project to Poiron's directly. They don't project the projection neuron. I mean, the interneurons, do they connect the projection neurons?
Right. So there is a complication here, as Alex pointed out, that there are downstream, there are also projection neurons, and they're also reciprocally connected to interneurons. That's true. The actual circuit is much more complicated. I'm showing you only one glimpse of it. Boris?
So you can just explain a little more what exactly we're looking at. So cluster centroids, so where are the clusters? How many clusters are there?
So actually, if you compute one, two, or three clusters, in both of those cases, the cluster centroid will look very similar.
So just the, I'm in the back of the room.
You can see two clusters,
two, or maybe
right?
Three or four.
It's easy to see two, right? This is one, and this is two. And actually, that has been known. It corresponds to aromatic and aliphatic compounds.
Okay.
And so our thinking is that this is a boring and redundant piece of information that has to be normalized out by the interneuron.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because this is like whitening, where the sensory system is trying to get rid of the trivial correlations, which have to do with the chemical structure of the molecule, to be worried about more interesting distinctions within those subclasses.
So, where are the concentration here?
Yeah, so this plot is the highest concentration that they presented.
That's how, I mean, is it relevant as concentration? Why that concentration?
Okay, so I have to tell you a little bit more how those orderings were chosen. These are what they call cognate orderings, meaning that these are the orders most private to a particular receptor, meaning that only one receptor is responding, well, is gauged by calcium imaging, to the highest possible concentration, right? So if you go to lower concentration, you just have a diagonal line. So then there are no correlations to look at.
Corresponding to the lowest concentration.
I'm sorry?
You said to the highest, so the lowest concentration.
Well, you increase at lower concentration, you always have one responding.
Right.
Then you increase concentration, and you look at the highest concentration where it's still one receptor responding. Okay? And the chemical that gives you the highest concentration where this is still true is the cognate order.
But that's not the concentration.
That's not the concentration. You go beyond that. Well, except for this one, for most of them, you go beyond that. Otherwise, there wouldn't be correlations in RN. There's nothing to look at.
So,
I'm still hung up on the question I asked in the very beginning about the sort of clustering. So you assume that there is some Euclidean metric, you know which points are close together, and then you cluster according. But in the very beginning, when you set up the similarity idea, you were working with sort of more general concepts. And it wasn't at all clear, for example, what makes pets similar and what features I should be looking at to define similarity. For example, all things with tails are pets, but then my pet rock doesn't comply to that. So there is sort of an inverse problem of actually trying to figure out what makes things similar, what is the metric, what are the features to look at. And here it's not clear to me.
That's still part one. Still part one.
Okay. Fine, I shut up. I'll listen.
Okay, it's just one slide away and we'll move on. Matt's here.
It's an interesting observation in that paper is that you have different types of Kennington neurons. You had normal ones, computes, you managed to retrieve them all. Connected.
So for experts, okay, this is true for all broad tree of interneurons. Okay, so this is all true for each one of those three. It is not true for the duet or the keystone. And that's where we are failed at the moment. We could not find the correspondences for those. We don't know. It could be the deficiency of our model. It could be the deficiency of the olfactory data set. We're still trying to sort that out.
I just want to make sure I understand. The clustering on the right emerges from the chemical properties of the receptors.
That's right.
And the argument is that the synaptic weights that you measure are consistent with what you should do in response to that kind of cluster.
That's right. To normalize out the trivial correlations having to do with the chemical, boring aspects of the chemical structure of molecules.
But this clustering, that what's on the left doesn't produce what's on the right. What's on the right leads to...
No. This is measurement of activity here. Okay? And in fact, the feedback synapses do not go to the cell bodies. They go to the axonal terminals, which is not... what is being measured here. So this is the measurement from the cell body. So thank you, this is an important distinction. So there is kind of a substation here. And we are looking now whether the activity patterns there reflect this normalization. Okay? So, well, now that we got into this larva, fly larva olfactory space, it's so exciting that I couldn't stop at this, right? So the fly larva olfactory system, this was just the front end, okay? Then, since we mentioned, there are projection neurons that receive one-to-one inputs from the ORNs, well, at least some of them do, and then they project to Kenyon cells, and the Kenyon cells is where, this is a divergent projection, and this is where the identity of objects is represented, because from that point on, you have already learning in terms of the actions and onto this muscle body output neurons. And there is a single giant interneuron, okay? So what we are saying is that, okay, we think that we understand something about the first stage, kind of whitening the inputs, right? Removing those trivial correlations. But then in the second stage, that whitened information gets clustered into different olfactory objects. That's what we think is happening in KCs. And without going into details, there are a lot of models actually of this transformation, including, for example, Tatiana's, that look at this transformation from the perspective of compressive sensing, and sparse coding, and so on. We think that clustering actually offers a lot of advantages in terms of looking at this system. It explains a whole lot of biological observations. For example, you know, the fact that neurons are non-negative and they're rectifying is natural from the clustering perspective, because clustering, you know, assignment indexes have to be non-negative. There is a single giant interneuron here, right? And the same is true for clustering, right? For clustering, there is a simple constraint that the norm of the assignment index factor is less than one, and that's why you need one interneuron to enforce this constraint. We suggest that the connectivity should be non-random because it reflects, again, correlations. And we get sparse over complete representation. Of course, in hard clustering, just one KC will be active in response to each order. But in soft clustering framework, which we also have, a small subset of KCs will be active. And the strong evidence in favor of the clustering view, as opposed to, say, compressive sensing decoding view, is that there are KCs that respond to a mixture of orderings, but do not respond to any of the individual components, right? Which wouldn't be the case if you did compressive sensing. So I just wanted to put it out there because it says something about a factory processing. Okay. All right, so now to answer Boris's question, is there anyone who hasn't seen the solution? Okay, so you all know that it's old lady or young lady, depends, you know, how you look at it, but it's the same pixel intensity vector. And this is, of course, extreme, just visual illusion, but what it really, it's really this Petrock example that Boris gave, when there are two examples from different categories that are really close to each other in the pixel space, how are you going to pull them apart, ever? Okay? And one of the views of how the visual system does things like that has to do with manifold untangling, where one category lives on one manifold in a high-dimensional pixel intensity space. Another object lives, category objects from another category live on another manifold. And what the visual system does, of course, you cannot classify this with a linear classifier easily because there are so manifolds are so entangled. So what the visual system does, it tries to put the manifolds, pull the manifolds apart without destroying neighborhood relationships within each manifold. So locally, each manifold structure is preserved, right? So when you pull them apart, you maintain generalization within the manifold. But as they're pulled apart, you can classify in the end simply by linear classifier. Okay, so that's one view of how the visual system operates. And the reason you need so many layers is because it's difficult to pull those manifolds apart, and it takes many layers.
I think we'd like to give you the space to finish.
Okay. Okay, five more minutes. Okay. Okay. So, how can we solve that? And you know, this idea, this requirement that you have to preserve local neighborhoods, made us think about using similarity alignment for that, right? Because remember, similar input corresponds to similar output, so we want to preserve neighborhood relationships, at least locally. And so we applied similarity alignment to that. So this here is our sample data set. So data points live on two spirals. They're now entangled, okay? So these are not two clouds well segregated from each other. And we throw those points, like in the clustering example, onto this network with just two output neurons because we want to have two clusters. We had to modify the objective function a little bit so that it respects Euclidean distances rather than just similarity, but that's technicality. The bottom line is that it didn't work, right? So the two neurons just learn to represent this part of the one spiral, this part of another spiral. If you change alpha, they grab more and more, but then they kind of represent points from different spirals. It doesn't work. So what are we going to do? Is this idea dead? Well, no, because otherwise I wouldn't be telling you about this. If you, instead of having two principal neurons, have 30 or more principal neurons, then there is something interesting happening, because each neuron learns to respond to a small neighborhood on one of the spirals. Together, all these neighborhoods from 15 neurons span one spiral completely with some overlap. But they never represent data points from two different spirals. Other 15 neurons spend the other spiral. And that gives us hope, right? Because now we learn to represent this manifolds, okay, in one layer, and then these are two different neurons. So if you had just one supervisory signal, we could linearly cluster this representation. Okay? Of course, you know, what we really want to do is to apply this to the example of, you know, from vision. And if you run our network like this on natural stimuli, it does learn Gabor patches like Holzhausen and Field. So it shows it's a good sign. But we would like to stack those networks on top of each other, like the cortical areas in the visual pathway, to move from one feature representation to another set of features, to learn new features as you go along. Can we do that? The short answer is that not yet. We cannot solve the pattern recognition problem yet. But I want to show you one example that makes us think that maybe we're on the right track. And this is, again, going back to the spirals. I took even more entangled pair of spirals, red and blue. Of course, the network is not seeing the colors. It's blinded, but it sees all those data points one after another. And as I told you before, in the first layer, it already learns the manifold structure so that the similarity matrix gets transformed so that in the first layer, the group of neurons represent one spiral, another spiral doesn't overlap. But if you stack those layers one on top of each other, decreasing the number of channels each time by a factor of two until you get to just two neurons, then the clustering solution emerges. So these two manifolds get pulled apart, just like we wanted to, in a completely unsupervised fashion. And the last layer is a simple hard clustering solution. So in this particular simple example, I admit it, we were able, by stacking those layers of the clustering network, soft clustering network, to pull them apart and disentangle the manifolds.
Layer 1,
yeah.
They're all on the diagonal. But yes. What gives the right order? Did you permute them?
No, of course. I permuted the example. So these are the blue points and these are the red points.
Okay, so it is just the individual pixels and the pixel is either red or blue. So nothing has happened.
No, but the network doesn't see the color. The network is blinded to the...
A pixel is a pixel.
No. You give a it's a two-dimensional vector. You give a two-dimensional vector to the network, and it managed to learn the neighborhood relationships. And if you were able to magnify here, in the center, you will actually see that there is a bow tie here, right? So the blow up of this would be like that. So you go like this. This is what the network does, and then in the middle. It has this. So the similarity is completely segregated because no neuron responds to the points from the two clusters. But the neighborhood relationships are encoded in this diagonal structure. Okay? So the diagonal structure is not one pixel wide. Okay? This is like several pixels. And that's because, right, because the response of that first layer is like this, right? Each neuron responds to a small neighborhood of points. So if I compute the similarity, in this point, this data point activates, well, better to look here. This data point activates this, this, and this neuron, for example.
We'll do it online. I don't mind. We'll do it online.
All right. Well, sorry, but I think
it'll
I have...
be offline learning.
Yeah.
It looks like this may scale badly for more complex tasks. Like if you need this many layers to disambiguate two categories, is there a way that you could still disambiguate many categories with a small number of layers?
If you allow a supervisor input. Okay, because these spirals in this high-dimensional space of activities do have a direction in which you can cluster them linearly. Even in the first layer. It's just that the the corresponding eigenvector has a very small eigenvalue. So when you embed it in 2D, you're not going to get it. That's why you need all the other layers.
Yeah, right.
So if you have any kind of semi-supervised signal, even just for one example in each category, it's sufficient to know what direction you should choose. But we want it to stay pure, to do it completely unsupervised, which is maybe too much to ask. But I just wanted to show this, okay? So to summarize, okay, so we developed this idea of similarity alignment, which is basically a mathematical trick to build Hadean anti-Hadean networks into this whole family of different algorithms, where we have a mapping between different mathematical components of those objective functions and biological properties that, you know, we've known experimentally for a long time. And so now we can go between the two, and we have a computational interpretation for all those biological, physiological, or anatomical details. And this is, was mostly done initially in my group, but more recently other people got involved. And so I want to leave you with this claim that the similarity alignment approach allows you to build biologically plausible networks performing non-trivial computations in a relatively straightforward way. And this is all part of what the group does, which is the application of off-the-shelf machine learning algorithms to analyze experimental data, but also use experimental neuroscience data to build new machine learning algorithms. And finally, these are the people who were involved in this work, which are, you know, past and present members of the group. And I was really fortunate to work with such a fantastic scientist. Thank you.